Hello, dear listener. This is Ian Lee, and welcome to a special one-off special, got those words the wrong way round, episode of the Pocket Radio Show. I'm going to do these from time to time when I come across something that I think you should know about or something that doesn't quite fit into my BBC Three County Show. Podcast is available. Go to iTunes, type in Ian Lee BBC. It pops up. You can download it. And just when I get the whimsy to do such a thing. Well, this is a special looking at a brilliant singer-songwriter that nobody knows is a brilliant singer-songwriter, or only a handful of people do. It's Dennis LeCorriere. He was the lead singer from Doctor Hook. Not the eye patch, that's the other guy, for goodness sakes. For goodness sakes. But he also does a pretty darn good act himself. He's got a few solo albums out. He's on tour at the moment. And I reckon you should go and see him. I really do. It's a cracking night. I've been a few times. Yes, I've taken my mum. Mums are optional. But it's a cracking night. He's a brilliant singer-songwriter. He'll sing a few hits. He'll do a load of songs you've never heard of but you'll love. And he will keep you enthralled with his stories. Anyway, I spoke to him, and this is what he had to say.
A couple of years ago, I got a set of bongos for Christmas.
Hey, Dennis, can you hear me?
I could hear you on my mobile phone, too. But.
This is a ridiculously complicated setup involving me speaking into a microphone with headphones and a computer running. I never managed to get it right, but it's working now. I'm recording you. Shall we get straight into it?
Yeah. Better you call my landline. I have this really dodgy mobile phone that just keeps going off.
Well, listen.
It just goes off in the middle. You know, I'll be rabbiting away, and I'll look down, and my screensaver I'll be looking at. You know?
Listen, that's because people have hung up on you because you go on too long.
But
well done, Dennis. You're calling it a mobile phone, not a cell phone. So you're becoming accustomed to our ways.
Yes, but I never knew the difference. But a cell phone, you don't want to. You know, a cell phone seems very, I don't know, clandestine these days, doesn't it? I don't want to have anything to do with a cell at all, you know.
Listen, man, how are you doing, first of all? How is life treating you?
I'm good, man. I'm okay. You know, I'm kind of bouncing back a little bit. I had a year, almost 2 years of kind of weird. I had some immigration problems. I mean, nothing personal, just all papers, cross T's and dot I's and stuff like that, and somebody was supposed to write a letter to somebody, and they didn't, and while I was sitting here waiting to get residency, instead I received a letter saying, who the hell are you, and why are you still here?
We don't want people like you over in this country, for goodness sakes. Get out of here, you damn
singer-songwriters. I know what you mean. I'm really bad news. No, but it was weird for a while, because I tell you, the dynamic I was facing was, very nice of the government. They allowed me to stay while it was being sorted, you know, which was nice because I'd been here long enough. But I couldn't work because I didn't have a proper work permit. So while I couldn't work, I also had to hire these immigration attorneys that are not cheap, and that, you know, you don't defer any payments. You have to pay them before they do anything. So it was just a year of me going, a year, maybe 15, 16 months of me kind of going backwards. And I have to tell you the truth, man. I mean, I've been through a lot of stuff in my life, but having, at my age, having where I'm allowed to live, my human rights come up for question, was kind of almost about the scariest thing personally that I've been through.
I have a life here,
and, you know.
I know you're a colonial. People are picking up on the accent. Why do you live here, Dennis? Why aren't you, you know, working around the States? Why are you in Britain?
Well, first of all, when I used to come over here with Hook, you know, I loved England. I loved it here before I got here, because when I was 14, 15 years old, you guys started sending over all that great music that just opened my eyes, you know. I mean, all of it, the Beatles, the Hollies, the Yardbirds, I mean, I could go on. And so when I got here, you know, there was high anticipation in me about what I might find, but I just liked it. And you know, Liverpool, believe it or not, is very much like where I come from. I mean, they had the Mercy River, but I had the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And there were the docks and you know, big buildings across the river and stuff, and very working class, and you know, work their asses off all week and then like to have a good time on the weekend. And it was very much the same kind of stock, and you know, and so I'm going back to answer your question, but all the time I toured here with Dr. Hook, I don't know, there was something I really liked about it. It's not big and vast like the States, and I know when people from here, they want to go to America because everything's so big, but man, when you do what I do, you know, especially now, I'm not looking for world domination anymore, you know, I mean, not that I ever was, I say anymore, I mean, you know, but the United States is big, and it's hard to negotiate, and they don't know about you, you know, even if you're popular one area, you're 500 miles away, yeah. They have no idea who you are, you know, I've used the expression before, but you, to have any kind of success in America, you have to set yourself on fire in New York and hope that somebody smells the smoke in Los Angeles, you know what I mean? And it's a little bit too, you know, when I was younger, I was willing to go along with the ride and see how far Dr. Hook could go, and we traveled the world, and I was everywhere else but home 280 days a year, but that was, you know, that was cool for a young guy, and I was seeing a lot of stuff, but it was pretty all-consuming, and it was all I did, you know.
Now, Dr. Hook, you listen, Dennis, you mentioned Dr. Hook, right? Are we allowed to talk about it? It's not, is it a dirty word to you?
I don't know why, I guess because I was a little stubborn for a while and wanted people to know that, you know, every time they spoke to me, it wasn't posthumously. You know, and so I put out solo albums, and I you know, I see things online, and, you know, I've learned not to look. But there were people that think that, you know, I saw something a couple of weeks ago where a woman said, Dennis doesn't like us to listen to Dr. Hook. I don't care. That's great. But, you know, if you're going to speak to me, if everything you want to talk to me about it happened 35 years ago,
yeah.
It doesn't hold my interest. I'm sorry. I mean, I get it, and I appreciate it, but, you know, it's a springboard for me. The things I did years ago were cool, and they were great, but it's either something that pushes me forward, or it's a millstone around my neck. I mean, you know, I have the same argument with a lot of people, and I say, but it's a little bit of a graveyard to stay there.
Yeah.
And they say, yes, but there's flowers. And I say, yes, but there's dead people, you know? and so I know, and this was all to answer your question, are we allowed to talk about
yeah.
Man, I love talking about Hook, but you know, when I do interviews and the first question is, hey, so how did the band break up?
I need to scrub a question off here. I'm not interested in the band broke up. Now, let's listen, because I know you're doing a solo tour, and we're going to give out the dates, and you've got solo albums out, and you know I love them. I think they're brilliant. We'll get to those in a minute. A few Hook questions, because for a lot of people, Dr. Hook are that, when you're in love with a, mm-hmm. that's that band. Permission to speak freely. I don't even like that song. I don't like when you're in love. We get the joke. It's about erections. We, you know, I get it.
I suppose it is.
It's an innuendo. Yeah. But what people don't realise is the first two or three or maybe even four Dr. Hook albums are filthy. You were a filthy, semi-subversive kind of New York country bar band.
And you know not only, you know, a little spicy edge with things like Freaking at the Freaker's Ball.
That's not spicy, but, man. That's beyond spicy.
Yes, but no, but I'm saying, especially for the time, I suppose.
Yes.
But, you know, when you talk about those first four Dr. Hook albums, man, I love those albums. I mean, you know, we were stumbling through, but we were armed with great material.
Yep.
We were writing some okay stuff, but mostly we had Shel Silverstein.
Yep.
And he was giving me, as a young singer, songs like Sylvia's Mother, The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, Carry Me, Carry.
Carry Me, Carry.
Songs
what a
that
song.
I could really put myself into it. You know, years later, about the year before Shel passed away, and he's been gone for, geez, I don't know, 10 or 12 years, I said to him, why did you trust me? I was a young hippie, what, your kid. Why did you trust me with such worldly songs? Because Shel was an older guy than me. And he said, because you've always been an old soul. And I thought that was lovely, man. I really liked that. But I tell you, I did get those songs. And I think when I listen to, you know, I still get them. And what I love about them is there's something to get.
Yeah.
You know, and by the time we got to Sexy Eyes, which was a huge hit, which sold more as a single than all those four albums you talk about together, because it was of the time, and it's a good radio record, and we needed that kind of success, and it wasn't challenging. It wasn't Carry Me Carry about a guy living in a doorway. Mm. You know, not exactly what you want to listen to when you go out to a party, you know. But you know, we did those albums later on, and there were some good songs on there as well. There were some nice things that I didn't really mind singing, and Beautiful Woman was one of them. I didn't hate that song because I tell you what, if you listen to the song, not the record, the record was very much Rock Your Baby, boom, chicka, boom, chicka, boom, that disco thing. But if you listen to the song, it's pretty dark. I mean, it's about a guy who can't even answer the phone because people hang up and he doesn't trust. I mean, if the police would have done that.
I'd never thought of it quite like that.
You know what I mean? It really is. And there's minor chords in it as a song itself. I mean, you know, it's that, you know, maybe it's just an ego problem. I mean, the guy is this, you know, I mean, the lyrics are not, are pretty good, especially for that period of time.
Is it frustrating for you that the Dr. Hook songs that you're known for are Sexy Eyes and When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman, and yet there are these amazing stories in, like you say, The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, all of these kind of incredible songs that a lot of people know, who have a vague awareness of your history, don't know those songs. Is that frustrating?
I know. A woman said to me a couple of weeks ago, I'm the biggest Dr. Hook fan in the world. I have your greatest hits album. And that means that she knows about 15 of the songs.
Wow, she must really love you.
Yeah, no. And, you know, bless her. I mean, bless her, because there's all kinds of Dr. Hook fans, you know. And these days, I tour with a guitar, and, you know, just me and plenty of songs. And I play things from the second album, and I play things from the third album, and I play songs that hopefully people will go, wow, I never thought I'd hear them sing that. Because that's what I want to hear from people, you know. I mean, when I go to see McCartney, I love Paul McCartney. I can't help it. I love Paul McCartney. I take a bullet for the guy. But, you know, Live and Let Die with the same explosions. Man, there's a million songs I'd like to hear you sing. And so I approach it that way. And, you know, it's not the best commercial advice I could give somebody these days. I mean, I'm known for this catalog that's probably worth something, but, you know, it's only worth what it's worth to me. Mm. I didn't write a lot of the songs, and if you want to go back to that period of Beautiful Woman and Sexy Eyes and that whole shift into the dance music, and at that point, Dr. Hook were home fishing, and I was in the studio with the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, or the A players down in Nashville, because we were trying to cut big time records, okay? We weren't in the studio experimenting and loving what we were coming up with. We were on the road. We'd come off the road. We had 2 weeks to cut an album and get the hell back on the road. So we used the eight players everywhere. And generally it was me and those players. And you know, it was emergency times, man. We had gone bankrupt. We had families. We needed the band to get on the radio. We needed to make our concert audiences bigger. And at that point, music like that is what was going to do it. We still, you know, the show was still very much Dr. Hook. And there was still things like Carry Me and stuff in the show. I used to say whenever we had a hit single, the show used to get 3 minutes longer. I mean, that's, you know, it didn't change all that much. Our hair got shorter, but there was a lot of that content, but not enough. Not enough. We started doing songs like You Make My Pants Want to Get Up and Dance, which is a cute little rock and roll song written by a really good writer named Sam Weedman, who wrote some brilliant songs. But we did that. It was a B-side, and, you know, it was emergency times. I sang those songs because the band needed to get out of this slump and needed to move ahead. And, you know, I liken it these days to kind of like when the plane crashes and you eat some of the dead passengers to live, okay? That doesn't mean that 15, 20 years later I'm looking to take a bite out of anybody. I know why I did that. I did it for the good of everybody. And when you say to me, does it bother you? I'll tell you what bothers me the most. You can look online and find plenty of stuff out there about how I ruined the band.
Oh man, you don't want to go online,
sing
Dennis.
All that crap.
You don't want to go online, Dennis. The internet is not a friendly place.
I know. I don't even care anymore because I used to think, several years ago that my job was to set the record straight.
Yeah.
But you know something? I kind of enjoy these morons walking around with all the wrong information.
Yeah.
I kind of like it that they don't have a clue. Because I do. I do have a clue and I know why things happened and people say, "How do you remember all this stuff about your career?" I can tell you that much about the Beatles, for goodness sake. I mean, why wouldn't I remember it about my life, you know?
When are you going to write a book, Dennis? When are you going to put it? Because this is a great story.
I'm never going to write a Dr. Hook book. I really am not. Right now I'm working on a monologue about my family that I've always wanted to do. And I see it's fashionable now to write these books from, like, birth to 18 and then college through into your job. I've been wanting to do this forever, but I always talk myself out of it with a simple, "Well, who's going to care?" And I find out at 64 I care. So what I've been doing is I've been writing little bits, little chapters and stuff, and I've been putting them on my blog space. It's called Mixed Signals. But I'm not going to get into the Hook days because, first of all, if I talk about my life, I'm not going to have a bunch of morons out there suing me or telling me I said that was not correct.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to have another slant on my life. I'm almost the last one left out of all the people I was raised with that's alive. So this is going to be my life, and I think it's kind of interesting, you know. At least it is to me, and so I'm putting it on my blog, at least to give myself the impetus to get it out there as I write it. And I'm writing it the way I speak, grammar be damned. I want it to sound like I'm saying it to you. So I am working on bits of that. But, Ian, to do a Dr. Hook book, it's got to be sordid tales, and it's got to be what Ray was doing, and then what do you think was going on in that room? Oh, Dennis knows, and I'm not doing that. Mm. And another thing is, I've spent a lot of time trying to balance my life so that I'm here now as well as being part of that old enterprise. And if I wrote a book like that, then I'd be 70 years old and my interviews would be, "So, did Ray really have an iPad?" I'm not going there. I'm not going to go there. I don't want to talk about other people's lives. I really don't. There would be nothing. I'd be in hell. I mean, if they offered me a lot of money, it's a little like skydiving. If you offered me untold amounts of money, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go up in a plane. I couldn't get anywhere near the opening, and I certainly couldn't jump. And so if somebody offered me the same untold things to write the Hook story, man, I'd sit home at my computer in tears because I would not want to do it. I don't want to tell. Plus, I'd need a team of attorneys. I have to run stuff, because people would go, "That's not what happened." And it wouldn't be an interesting story unless I told you interesting things.
Okay,
and
listen. Final Dr. Hook question.
Six sevenths of what went on is none of my friggin' business.
Final Dr. Hook question until I think of another one. Is it true that you as a band in the 70s misunderstood Sweden and did a concert naked?
What do you mean by misunderstood Sweden?
Well, that you kind of thought Sweden was all orgies and saunas and a bit more permissive.
No. We didn't think it was all, I Am Curious Yellow, no. But here's the deal. We were playing, it wasn't actually Sweden, it was Denmark.
And
we were playing the Roskilde Festival. We were headlining the Roskilde Festival in Copenhagen, outside of Copenhagen, and we were playing it. It was in the middle of the summer, and it was really hot, and out in the audience were mostly naked or semi-naked people.
Excuse me?
And for our encore, we said, "Well, what the hell?" And we came out in various stages of undress. And, some of us were lucky because we were, playing instruments.
You had a guitar to hide behind.
Ray was playing cowbell, so he had nowhere to hide. But, he had nothing to be ashamed of either, I'm proud to say, for him. But, no, and that was the thing. And then another time we did a show, and it was somewhere in the same era. And now we'd kind of done that once, and it wasn't quite as scary. And I think what we did was... you remember when the streaking era went on?
Yeah, there was a lot of streaking,
people were
wasn't
streaking,
there?
Sporting events.
You don't get that anymore.
There was, like, somebody would run across a sporting field naked, and It was streaking. It would show up in college campuses and stuff. And it was a big deal all over the world. It was a stupid little thing that lasted a while. And we, for an encore, kind of did that. Came out and streaked the stage and then ran back and flew on bits of clothes. But that was, you know, that was the end of that. But we always used to laugh and say, look, boys, we're going to stay naked until somebody notices.
You see, you can't imagine One Direction or Justin Bieber doing something like that as an encore these days.
Not really. You know, the thing about Hook, man, was we wanted it to be fun for us. And we were a bar band. We started playing, you know, where you had to play six sets a night till 3 o'clock in the morning, and drunks would come in and cowboys would come in and they'd all want to, you know, they all want to kill each other. Nobody ever wanted to hurt the band for some reason. Everybody loved the band. They used to come up to us and say, when the shooting starts, play louder. That was an instruction we got one night from some guy. And, but, you know, we used to play, and when you do that, man, you make up stuff, you know? Somebody says, you know this country song, and you go, yeah, fine. And you start doing, you know, dirty versions of Proud Mary and, you know, nasty, you start making, you know. And when Shell and the band found each other, it was really perfect because now instead of me doing a Bee Gees song, or I Shall Be Released, Shell gave me Carry Me, or something like that. And instead of the band taking, you know, something that was on Top 40 radio and doing a nasty version of it, we had Freaker's Ball. But we already had the attitude. We already had the attitude, and Shell's material was perfect to convey the attitude. And, you know, as much as it was the material, it was a way to get the band's personality out there. And in the early days, in those first four albums, the band was nothing but personality. Before we could even play that well, we had plenty of personality. And it was like, who are these guys, you know? And then later on, we cleaned it up. And yeah, you know, everybody does it, man. Everybody gets the hair cut and, you know, goes and says, okay, let's take this seriously, especially after we went bankrupt. That was scary for us to have families and filing for bankruptcy. And, you know, we'd had two singles. We'd had Sylvia's Mother and Cover Rolling Stone, and then it was like, okay, it's over, boys. And we had to regroup, and we regrouped, and money was borrowed, and we recorded the album that we titled Bankrupt.
Clever.
You know? As a joke, pretty much, and then the single wound up being a song called The Millionaire. So nobody knew what the joke was. Nobody out there knew what the joke was. But that was always the thing with
Now, listen, let's come up to date a little bit. I'm talking 20 years ago. The first time I saw you, because my mum, as you know, is a huge fan. And she had loads of albums, not just the greatest hits. She loved you guys. And I saw about 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, that you, suddenly out of the mists of time, Dennis Le Corrier is playing at the Mean Fiddler in Harleston, the fantastic little venue in a shitty part of town. And I was like, well, let's go. I'll get you tickets. And we went.
Well, was it the big room or the, because I played the Mean Fiddler small room first. It was like downstairs, you know, with water pipes. Yeah, it was a long time ago, man. It was a long time ago because the Dr. Hook Farewell Tour was in 85, and I didn't do anything till like, almost. Well, I think I came over in like 90. That probably was like 96 or 97, 98.
Right.
Like that. Mid-90s. Yep. Mid in there. And I came over and played with a couple of friends. You know, when I moved to Nashville after the Farewell Tour in 1985, I moved there, although I'm from New Jersey, the New Jersey, New York area. I moved to Nashville because I had made some friends there and had some connections, and I thought I would go there and write and just be in and around the music business. I was not looking to go back on the road, you know, right away. I didn't know what I wanted to do. As a matter of fact, all I was absolutely sure of, Ian, was that Hook had run its course. And now we were, hey, I remember you guys, and if you're just going to remember me, you can remember me from home. And I stopped. So I knew that, but it wasn't because I had some major plan. As a matter of fact, there's another thing, don't look on the internet. Some guy's talking about what an a-hole I am, because just when the band was doing well, I split and went solo. And that's not even true. Ray left the band in like 1981, and the rest of us went on for another 3.5, 4 years and did a proper farewell tour and blah, blah, blah. And the reason I didn't keep the band together was because, you know, we would have needed another record deal, and that would have been another commitment of 2 or 3 years, and I just couldn't see it. And nobody in the band complained that it was over. I mean, everybody was a little shocked because this is all we'd done for 15 years. But, you know, I was the youngest guy in the band, and I said to the couple of them, you know, you should have had a paper route before I was born, man. I can't worry about what you're going to do right now. I don't know what I'm going to do right now. And so I stopped, and I went to Nashville, and I wrote some songs, and I got to sing on a lot of people's albums, like John Hiatt, and which is cool because I love John Hiatt. And you know, sang on other things. Kenny Rogers, Brenda Lee, just went in and sang background harmonies. Randy Travis, Travis Tritt. For a little while, I did jingles up in Chicago. And you can make a lot of money doing jingles. But I was in there, you know, for Long John Silver's fish restaurants, singing, "You're gonna make me," you know, souling out for fish. And I thought, well, I can make a living singing in another context. And so I kind of gave up the jingle thing. But I saw that you could actually make a good living, but man, come on. I mean, really, Burger King? You know, I mean, not that Burger King, I'm not even judging it as a product. I mean, that's not what I want to do. I don't want to go anywhere near that. If you think Sexy Eyes, you know, put a chink in my armor, you know. So it was actually fun to go in and apply myself to other people's material and know that I was going to go home and they were going to get on the bus and go on the road. But, you know, straight out country stuff, and you know, with Randy Travis and then John Hiatt, where he said to me, "Man, I love the way you sing, but I just want you to catch an attitude above me." You know, he just wanted me to go up there with him, and I loved it, and I got to do a lot of things that way. But that kind of ran its course, too, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And the first thing that happened was EMI Records here in the UK wanted to put out a Hook compilation, and they asked me if I would write some liner notes. And I was writing the liner notes, and man, it was a Hook compilation, you know, with all those songs that everybody tells me I ruined the band with. More like the movie, Sexy Eyes. When, you know, when they put out a compilation, man, they don't go back and get Carry Me. They go, you know, Only 16, a little bit more, if not you, More Like the Movie, Sharing the Night Together.
By the way, can I just say, dear listener, if you've never heard More Like the Movies, go and download
that. That's Shel Silverstein in the middle of our slickest period, shining through, you know. And I've always been partial to If Not You because I wrote it and it meant something to me, you know. But, you know, the songs were great radio records, and they were good, slick songs. But, you know, when you go from singing lines like that are in the Ballad of Lucy Jordan, and then you wind up singing, you know, We Better Get It On Now in a little bit more, or Sexy Eyes, you know, I was sitting all alone watching people get it on with each other. And it's like, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be elitist. Everybody has their own style, but I would not have written that song at gunpoint just because I don't think like that. I never met a girl on the dance floor in my life. And I would not have recorded that song if it was the Dennis LeCourier show. I wouldn't have done it. I would have done what I do now, which is struggle on with the best, you know, because when people tell me the best of Dr. Hook, I got my own ideas of what the best of Dr. Hook is. And I try to give them that nightly. And what I've taken to doing now is at the end, when I come out for an encore, I pretty much just ask them what they want to hear. And you know, because I tell the audience every night, you know, folks, the truth of the matter is that every time I sing a song that makes one of you think, "Oh, I'm so glad he's singing that again," it makes another one of you think, "Oh, why the hell is he singing that again?" And that's how I live. That's the dilemma of my life if I just toss it out to popular vote. Funnily enough, they will shout more for The Ballad of Lucy Jordan or Carry Me Carry or The Soup Stone from our third album, more than they will When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman, a song that's real popular is years from now, which Roger Cook and Roger Greenaway wrote, because everybody in the world got married to that song. Everybody. I hear it every week in an email somewhere, maybe a couple of times. I have for the last 30 years, And I said that on stage the other night, and in the queue at the end, when I was saying hello to people and signing a few things, three people came up to me, three different couples. Two of them had used it as their wedding song, and one of them was about to. You know, and that's a song I wish I would have wrote, because it's a lovely song.
And that must be amazing, having had that kind of impact on people's lives. You know, that you are invited to such a significant
wedding. It's so hard, because I'm not in showbiz. I don't take my temperature that way. I don't stay out there. I don't have showbiz friends. I don't go to those parties. I'm not connected. I could never be, and I swear to you, I'm not saying this because it didn't happen for me. I could never be a Bruce Springsteen. I don't need that much attention. I'm not saying he needs it, but I could not, I don't want that. Let's say that. I don't want that much attention. I don't want to, you know, go out and campaign for presidents and play, you know, I wouldn't want that demand on my life. I just wouldn't, you know. So I always say I try to, you know, I'm trying to be like the most famous recluse in the world, you know, but I don't really do that. I don't really, so I'm just, you know, I just kind of struggle on, and I don't really look for that. And it's hard to, I want to take the best of what I think I have to offer. I'm going to Australia next year. I'm going to give the UK a little bit of a rest. I've been touring here a lot, and, I need to just see what else there is, you know, and Australia made me an offer, and the first offer they made me was, you know, that I fly over and pick up a band there and go around to the casinos and play the hits. And I said, it's too far away. It's too far away. I can't, I don't want to do that. So we talked a little bit and talked back and forth a little bit, and I said, I don't want to do that, but I would like to come. And they said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I'd like to actually come here alone with my guitars and do the one-man show that I've been doing. Because here's the thing, Ian. I was there with Dr. Hook on the farewell tour in 1985. Then I didn't go back for 15 years, and I went back with a band from here. I went back with a band and did, you know, some of the stuff from my new album from Out of the Dark at that time, and a lot of Hook stuff, and it went really well, and now it's been 14 years since I've been there, you know? So if I'm going to go once every 15 years, when I go this time, I want it to be personal. I want it to be, hey, it's me, I'd like to talk to you, tell you, you know, and maybe, I don't know how they'll respond to it. But, you know, we're calling it something. I don't really refer to Hook here a lot in billing, because I think calling it the voice of Dr. Hook, I don't know. Anyway, it sounds like a ventriloquist act. But over there, in Australia, down there, we're going to call the show Dr. Hook and Beyond. And it clearly says on the poster, right, he's back with his unique one-man show. And I'm still going to get people saying, whoa, where are you banned? You know, but I need it to be personal this time, man, because that's the other thing. I'm going down there every 15 years. I mean, Jesus, that's nice and fair, you know, that I go down there 15 years older every time they see me. You know, and you know the other thing? I'm going to be sitting on a chat show, and they're going to be showing a clip of Dr. Hook, and then they're going to pan to me, and it's going to be like, and here's his dad, you know. And I'm going to have to live with that, you know. But here they've gotten to see me over the last 10 years. And there they see me, it's like time-lapse photography. And, you know, I think I'm doing all right, not to blow my own horn, but I think I look like an older version of the same guy. I don't think I've morphed into, you know, because I told somebody recently, the day I walk out on stage and the whole audience kind of collectively gasps, I think I'll probably pull it, you know, I'll probably cancel the tour or something, you know. But I'm
going to
go.
Now, listen, just interrupt, because you mentioned, you do, I think partly because of the hair and the beard, you look similar. And I mentioned to my son, who's 3 and a half, that I was interviewing you, and he was like, well, who is he? And I showed him a picture. He laughed. Don't take that personally, Dennis. He laughs at lots of pictures. But he had two questions for you. Do you mind if I ask you the two questions for my eldest son?
Absolutely. 3 and a half. This is great.
So the two questions are, how long is your beard? And what's the longest you've ever had?
My beard right now is just normal length, you know, just kind of trimmed down around the shape of my face. But when I was a kid and they threw me out of school for having long hair and attempting to grow a beard, I really let it go, and I had hair down, like, you know, to the middle of my back, and I had a beard. Let me see. If I was wearing my Jaws T-shirt, and this won't mean anything to your boy because he's 3 1/2, but the Jaws T-shirt had that icon of the shark coming out of the water with his nose pointing up.
Yep.
And you couldn't see his nose.
I know the image.
That's how long my beard was.
Fantastic. Okay. He'll be very chuffed with that. So you're going to Australia. Is it because you're on tour at the moment? There's loads of dates. We're going to plug all of those. You go to DennisLeCorio.com.
Yeah, DennisLeCorio.com will tell you everything you need to know.
But we'll run through them and stuff because there's loads of dates. What tour are you doing? Are you doing the tour with the band or are you doing the one-man show with you
right
and
now?
Guitar and a load of stories?
Right now, it's a continuation of the tour I was doing at the beginning of the year, which was the solo thing. It's called the Point Zero Tour.
Right.
And I called it the Point Zero Tour pretty much because of what I told you about the immigration. Everything kind of came to a big, and now I have to take a look. I have to reassess, have to go travel, you know, far afield and see what I want to do with my life and look at it. So it was sort of like I was at point zero. And, you know, some people might see that as a negative zero, but sometimes I have a friend who says that, you know, sometimes when you're drowning and you're trying to get your head above water, the best thing you can possibly do is sink all the way to the bottom and push off. And that's kind of what the point zero tour is. It's kind of what I'm doing, you know.
And for those who are thinking, oh man, it's just a guy and a guitar. It's going to be a dreary night. James Taylor, who I've got a lot of respect for. I like James, but it's not at all. There are the softer songs. There are the kind of introspective stuff. But
it's definitely machine gun folk music, man. It's not a drone. Yeah. It doesn't.
That's,
you know, it's not like 30 minutes into the show, you think someone's hoovering. That's not it. I tell you what, I was out signing the other night. I played somewhere. I forget where it was, and I was signing, and some guy came up to me and he said, you know, when I walked in tonight and I saw one microphone up there, I thought, uh-oh. And I went, really? Yeah. And he went, well, yeah. And I said, why? Did you think there was going to be a band?
Yeah.
He said, no. I thought, another guitar, harmony or something. And I thought, how's this guy going to pull this off? He said, man, I am so glad you didn't have a band. Because you know what they don't get? And I'm sorry to say this, but it says Dennis LeCorriere on the poster, okay? What they don't get when there's a band is as much Dennis LeCorriere. Because there's a band, and there are guys back there, and the spotlight guy is waiting to put the red spot on the guitar player when he does his solo. And if I rab it onto the audience, it's awkward for everybody, because I can see the audience go, looking, oh, well, he's talking, but the guitar player's just standing there. And I feel like I'm part of Cirque du Soleil on those nights, you know? And it's fun to have a band and everything. But it's, believe it or not, it's more self-indulgent than it is to do it alone. Because you can't really self-indulge when you're the only person up there. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and you know, have you heard that old expression, you should never define yourself by what you do for a living? Okay? Well, what I do for a living is define myself. That is what I do for a living.
Right.
And, you know, this promoter in Australia went, I said to him, look, man, you know I must be serious about this. You told me that I could come down there, pick up a band, you'd find them, I wouldn't even have to deal with it, except, oh, my God, would I be panic-stricken on the plane wondering who the drummer was going to be? You know, it's like going into the surgery thinking, are they going to put a monkey's heart in my chest, you know? But, so anyway, I said to the guy, I must be serious about this. Otherwise, I could have just said to you, yeah, pick them up, I'll go around, I'll take my money, I'll sing Sexy Eyes, and I'll go home. I'm telling you that I want to do 2 hours on my own. You know, and the guy went, yeah, I guess that's true. It wasn't like I was looking for less work. But you know something?
Yeah.
It, in some ways, it is not less work. There's less of a demand on me if all I have to do is be me. I don't know how to explain that any better, and I'm always willing, I have always been willing my whole life to rely on me. I was an only child, that was the way it went. You know, I take great comfort in when it gets down to, it's up to you, Dennis. It's sometimes I think, okay, thank goodness. Thank goodness it's just down to me. And I like that. And I got a lot of great songs, and I talk to them, and I walk them through it, and, you know, my songs are part of it. And, you know, now in Australia, I'll probably have to hark back some and do a few more of the hits up there alone because, you know, they see me once every 15 years. But I'm certainly not going to just go in and sing the hits and leave because, you know, and I want to tell them, I'm looking forward to telling them that in press and stuff that, you know, I'd like to come and, you know, say hi to you guys and actually get to know each other this time. It was always whirlwind with Hook. The last time I was there was the casino hits, casinos out. Let's just take a breath.
Let's just relax. Yeah. Let's just take our time.
Some of the venues are going to be a little nightclub-y, casino-y, because Australia likes that. They have a lot of those. But the bulk of them are art centers and little theaters and stuff. And you know, I got to get down there. I got to go see, you know, Hook was always popular. But, you know, the funny thing about the timing is Hook didn't really get popular down there until we had all those major hits. You know, the mainstream stuff. And so that's what they mostly know from me. And I'm going to, so when I play Carry Me, I wonder if how many people are going to go, I almost forgot that song. You know, I don't know this song.
They're going to shoot you. Dennis, they're going to shoot you, man.
Wear
a bulletproof vest.
I think if anybody was going to kill me during a concert, it would have happened already. To tell you the truth, you know. So, you know, we'll see what happens, man.
You're right.
The funny thing about getting older, and the only thing that really scares me about it, because I feel fine. You know, I feel fine. I really do. I always tell people, if you want to know how old you are, be doing at 64 what you were doing at 24, and you'll know exactly where you had to adjust, you know. And that's kind of where I am. But the scary thing is you don't really feel like you got the time to gamble, you know? When I was 20 years old and the proposition was, do I want to sign with Dr. Hook? Do I want to sign contract with this guy, his producer, this manager, who I didn't really care for very much? And do I want to do this? And then I waited and I said, but he's got Shel Silverstein, did that movie, and I can get to know Shel. And so I thought, I can give it 10 years. I can give it 10 years. And then when I was 30, I did the same. You know, when I was 34, 35, I got out of Hook, and I thought, I'll do this. And I, you know, and I sang, and I did this. And always in the back of my mind wondering if I would do it again. And I kind of came back at 50 and thought, this is cool. And at 60, I did my last album, Post Cool. And that's great. But I don't really feel like, you know, I could, now I'm 64, I don't really think I could say, you know, I'll just sit down, I'll give this another shot at 74. It gets a little more immediate, you know? You don't have the time to play with. And I don't even mean that in any kind of sad way. That's just the way it goes. Tick, tick, tick. You have to kind of adjust to what you're being given. So I don't really have a lot of time to play with. And I'm not really looking for, like I said to you earlier tonight, I'm not really looking for world domination. I don't think I'll ever have a hit. I don't really think I'll have any hit records. I mean,
well, I don't think hit.
No, I know, but I mean, having
now,
a hit.
Now the charts,
you know, I don't think I'm
going to
become a television personality. I don't think I'll be, you know, even though people think I'm funny, I don't think I'm going to wind up on panel shows because I don't go for them. I don't schmooze those right people because I don't really want to wind up there. I don't really know.
Have you ever been asked to do the?
I did Buzzcocks a long time ago when Mark Lamar was still on.
Did you?
Yes. Funnily enough, the night before, we taped it on a Tuesday, and the night before, I was washing some dishes in my sink, and a glass broke, and I cut the side of my finger almost off, peeled it down, I had to get like 12 stitches or 22 stitches, something in my finger, and it was all bandaged when I got to the studio the next day. And the next day after that, I was in the middle of a tour. I was thinking, oh, my God, what am I going to do? But I still had the TV show to deal with, so I showed up. And I spent all day shaking everybody's hand with this bandage that went all the way up my wrist, and nobody, not the producer, not the script girl, not the makeup people, not Bill Bailey, not Phil Jupitus, not Mark Lamar, nobody said, what happened to your hand?
Hey, that's TV, man.
I've never seen it. I've never seen
it
because I don't watch myself.
You also did a show, and I was surprised, with someone who was a great friend of mine. He's passed away now. Frank Sidebottom. Do you remember that? He was the guy with the... whisper it quietly. He had a big paper mache head.
Wow.
And it was set in his shed. I used to... Frank Sidebottom, I'm a huge fan of. He passed away a few years ago. But yes, you popped up on that.
Yes.
You mentioned Post Cool. That's your
third
solo
album?
Album?
And, you know, I mean, it could be my last one. I have no idea. No, I'm
don't
not saying
say,
that. I'm really
that,
not
Come
saying
on.
That, like, you know, doing a farewell tour so that people check my x-rays. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, you know, Post-Cool, I love that album. You know, there's 13 songs on there that
album.
I really,
it's like a
really
nice
love.
Folk album. It's lovely.
It didn't get promoted. You know, it didn't really, nothing really happened. My fans, closest fans, really like it. And I'm glad I put it out, especially if it's going to be my last one. But, you know, when it didn't do anything and radio didn't go near it, and even the company that licensed it from me didn't even, you know, said nothing about it. Nothing. I didn't see a review. I didn't see an ad. Nothing. It just laid there. I didn't see it in most stores when there still were a few stores. But, and I thought, okay, that's, you know, I can't take this personally. This is just life. But, you know, I'm not even sure what would I do? Would I now write another 13 songs that I really, really love and do what with them? You know what I mean? It's not that I don't have them or I wouldn't want to do it, but realistically, who am I targeting? You know? So I'm kind of like where I was with Hook. You know? So I don't, and so this would be the place where everybody would have the utmost respect for me and not look down at me at all if I were to do a duet with When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman with, you know, I don't know, The Wanted. The Wanted,
Miley Cyrus.
You know what I mean? Yeah, somebody, you know, he's run his course, he put out 3 albums, and nobody, so now he's, but, you know, no, I'd rather just go out in the woods and eat nuts and honey, man, you know, and bugs. I mean, I'm not...
Well, let me just mention, Dennis, let me mention the name, because Out of the Dark, one of the lucky ones, Post Call is my favourite of the three, if I'm allowed to pick a favourite. People should go and have a listen, because
the first two albums, I got the licenses back, and so... You can buy them individually, but you can actually buy them there's a two album box set called Retrospection, and it has both albums in it and bonus tracks and stuff. You know, and I love those first two albums, man. Me and Rod Smar, guitar player and dear friend of mine who was in Dr. Hook in the last few years of the band, we did those albums together in his basement, you know, on some digital equipment. I mean, literally in his basement. You know, in a low ceiling, and we just did it. And we had a wonderful time doing them. Out of the Dark, we recorded. We didn't even know that was ever going to come out. We were just doing it because I had all these songs, and Rod said, let's start recording them, you know. So we did. But I love those albums. And when I listen to them now, I like Post Cool, and I love the band I used, and we cut it as live, pretty much, you know. A lot of the vocals were what
it is
very live sounding, which was the idea of that album. And the other ones, it was, you know, me and Rod, we would bring in different instruments, so it wasn't going to be that live, but I really loved those albums too. I mean, when I listen to them now, I don't think, oh yeah, that's the clunky album. I think we did such a great job on those, and I'm happy with that. You know, I needed to have some kind of body of work for myself. You know, so people are going to come to me 60 years later and go, I'm your biggest fan, I know 12 of your songs, then I have to do something. Something. So that's what I've done. And you were great, man, when Post Cool came out. You know, you said a lot of lovely things. And
it's a cracking record. It's one of those things, it's frustrating when you're going around with this bit of plastic going, this is good, you should listen to this, and everyone's kind of shrugging their shoulders, and it's got Dance on Daddy's Feet, Sinking Ship, the sound...
Well, you know, something funny, but I realized in the last few years that, you know, I get emails from people in America, and they say, why don't you play here? And I say, well, because nobody there knows me apart from Hook, and that was a long time ago now. So I would have to come back and play the oldies in casinos, and it's not really what I want to do. And, you know, and some people argue with me, and say, you don't love your past, and you're you know. And I'm very reverent about my past. That's why I'm not singing Sylvia's Mother in a Chicken in a Basket Place, folks, because I am reverent about it.
But can I just say, by the way, I have seen former members of your band singing Sylvia's Mother
where?
In a Chicken in a Basket Place many years ago. Oh, this was...
Was I there?
Oh, man, this was... No, you were not there. Don't
worry. Yeah. Well,
the other
okay.
fella.
Yeah. All bets are off. I have no idea. But you know, but the thing is, the thing about that is that you know I am reverent about that stuff, and I kind of lost my point a little bit. But no, man. See here. Here's my point. People will wonder why I don't come and play in America. And when I say things like that, I don't want to come back and just play the oldies to, you know, And then you see things again online. Oh, Dennis, he doesn't sing any of the old songs. No, that's not what I said. I'm not coming back and acting as if I had been cryogenically frozen in the 70s wearing bell bottoms with a disco ball over my head. I'm not doing it. It's not going to happen. So people can say whatever they want, you know. But I got a nice letter from a guy, and he went, oh, same thing. Love you to come back. And I replied and said, you know, yeah, but, you know, there's this, there's that. And he said to me, and I got it right to my heart. He said, yeah, but see, that old hook stuff takes me back to a time I can never get back to again. And I sent back, but for me to provide that for you, I have to stay there. You can be writing your new novel and playing Dr. Hook. But if I stay Dr. Hook, if I write a new song, I have to throw it away. I have to assume you won't care. You could be introducing your brand new girlfriend to my old music, but I have to stay there. And I realized, take Post Cool, okay? I did that album when I was 60 years old. My fans, my Hook fans, will listen to Hook and remember when they were 25. If they like Post Cool, the best they're going to do is remember when they were 60. And it's not what it's about. They like those times. I mean, you know, hey, why are there so many tribute bands? Because nobody really cares about the band. They care about the way those songs make them feel. So that means I don't really even have to be there to have that kind of career. Yeah. And you've seen my show. You see, you know who I am. You see how I am. Have you ever known me to be anywhere and not be there?
Oh man, listen, you're there, you care about your show a lot more than some, you know, other heritage acts that I've seen where it is them doing the songs by numbers and going through the motions.
Yeah, well, no,
you
and
care,
it's not
man.
Even, I, you know, I care while we're talking here, you know, I hope people can hear that, that it's not, because it isn't, when I said to you a little earlier about, you know, people say don't define yourself by what you do for a living, and my answer was, but what I do for a living is define myself. I'm not Alice Cooper. Yeah. I don't go on stage as a vampire and then later on I'm a Christian and I play golf with Bill Clinton. This is the same asshole that goes on stage. People, when they talk to me, they go, oh, you're a funny guy. What's your show like? And I say, it's just like this, only I stop to sing.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can attest to that. You know, it's not like...
Oh, yes. He does stop talking occasionally, dear listener. I promise you.
One of the best reviews I ever got was Dennis to stop singing until he started talking, and then that wasn't too bad either. And I thought, well, that's good. That's all it should be, you know?
We've been talking for an hour, and an hour flies by with you. You're touring through through October and November, Southampton, Southport, Potter's Bar, the big show, November
the
7th,
Theater,
the Bloomsbury Theatre, London. That's,
I love that
that's
venue.
Venue.
I can see why a lot of comics and stuff actually do their DVDs and stuff there, because it's very easy to communicate with everyone, you know. It's a weeknight. It's a little tough. Yeah. You know, even some of my fans are going, gee, I don't know if I can get there on a Thursday. But, you know, people do what they do. It's a strange time and you know, very, very hard to take it personally. You want as many people to show up as will show up, obviously. But, you know, there is really no such thing as half an audience. You know, like sometimes the building is bigger than it needs to be. But there really is no, you know. And when I walk out on a stage, the only thing I'm concerned about immediately is that the audience is comfortable, because if they're comfortable then I'm fine. You know, because I walk out there to a couple of hundred, couple of thousand individuals, and I automatically need to make that into some entity that I could speak to as a person, you know, and they need to be comfortable. And when there's empty seats, they're shifting around like, oh, I bet you this is making him feel bad. And then my job becomes, don't worry about it, you know. We got enough people here for me to do what I'm going to do. I don't really have like a 50-person show and a 5,000-people show. It's kind of the same thing, you know.
November the 7th, Bloomsbury Theatre. You've got Cardiff, Eastney. Eastney's not a place, Dennis. They've sold you
a pub
there. There's no such place.
There's a place
I'm telling
called,
you that now as a British
a place
person.
Called the Cellars in Eastney, and it's a little place, and I played there, and it was actually really fun. And the thing that really struck me was, you know, they had like groups like the Zombies coming in, and I thought, where the hell are they going to stand? You know, and there was no place for a group, but so it'll just be me. Yeah, this fall thing is a lot of clubs. I played the Robin 2. I'm going to play the Brook in Southport. The Cardiff is another club. The Globe. Just want to do a couple of small gigs, and I'm going to wind it down.
Couple of the Oramori.
Yes,
Glasgow
I heard about
well,
that. And they wanted to do two nights. Glasgow's always been a good city for me, and you know, I did the concert hall so many times now that they expect me to show up with a cello. So I'm going to go do the Oramori for two nights and see what happens.
DennisLeCorriere.com is the place to go. Listen, I've got your three solo albums here. Can I play a song from one of your albums on the end of this podcast to kind of just so people know what,
what you're
becoming, where you are at the moment? Pick a song. Pick any
very
song.
Hard. You know, it's not. I'll tell you what. I'll tell you the song that I end every night with, okay? And it's the song that ends post-cool, Different Faces. And that...
Fantastic.
What I tell the audience every night is when I wrote that song, I looked at it and I thought, this is exactly what I should be saying at this point in my life. And the reason I end with that is because I do that segment where, you know, I sing whatever they want. We go, you know, a whole lot of oldies going on there. And then I take it back to, and this is what I think right now. And I don't know why that's so damn important to me, Ian, but, you know, it makes me check my pulse less when I let people know who I am now. You know what I mean? And that doesn't mean there's no old stuff in it, because I am that as well, you know? But, you know, if you'll play Different Faces, it's kind of very a very subdued song, and I don't know if it's the kind of track that will make people go, oh, so that's what he sounds like. But what are you going to do?
Dennis,
thank
it's
you, man.
Always a pleasure.
Are you
going
to come to the Bloomsbury?
I'll try and come along to the Bloomsbury. I'm hoping to come to the Bloomsbury. Well, let's ask the direct question.
Of course.
Is my name
going to
be
on
the door?
Do you know something? Do you know something?
There.
I should have told you this a long time ago, but your name is on the door every night I play anywhere. It's always on the door, and
you
never show up. Maybe because I didn't tell you. But
now he tells me when he's only got a few
you know,
more years left in him.
A guy actually said that to me the other night. A guy actually, first of all, he came up and he said, hey, man, my name is Big Bob, and I used to be your sound man over here. And he showed me a picture of himself sitting at a soundboard, which doesn't really tell me anything, because that means I could show you a picture of me playing guitar and tell you I was Eric Clapton, you know. But I know who our sound man was over here. He was a friend of mine. And then as he was leaving, he shook my hand very seriously and somberly and said, may the good Lord give you another couple of years. And I thought, Jesus, you just saw my show. Do I look like I'm about to peg it? You know, it's really great. Those are the three things I heard. I tell people, here's this what we'll end at. The other night, after I did a show, and I thought I did a really good one and really put it out there, and I thought really connected with the audience, when I was out there signing, a woman came up to me, and, you know, I changed my shirt after the show because the other one soaked, and I'm saying, and she came up to me and she said, I liked your other shirt better. Okay, so that was one review. The second one was a woman said to me, "You remember when you were younger?" And I went, "Yeah." And she went, "You know, when you were younger?" And I went, "Yeah." And she went, "You used to be gorgeous." And I said, "Thank you very much." And then a few people later, this guy came up and said, "Geez, I really hope you have another couple of minutes." And I turned to Adrian, my tour manager. I said, "They're killing me here. This is the part that's killing me. The show was fine. The thing is, they're talking me out of breathing as I'm standing here."
And we should just mention very quickly, you do
hang
around.
I come out and I say hi, and you know, I don't know why, because I like, you know, I like them to tell me that they don't like the way I dress. That's the kind of guy I am.
I'm sorry. If I made you cry or feel like dirt, if I caused you doubt or worry, there are no excuses I can give. Your compassion holds my fate. We learn these lessons as we live. Sometimes a little too late. And to anybody in my life to try to show me kindness and felt my indifference cut like a knife, please chalk it up to blindness. 'Cause I could not see or I would not see, but I did not know the truth. A young man blames his parents and an old man blames his youth. Sense to mention names or fill in blanks and spaces, 'cause every time I close my eyes, I'll see different faces. Yeah. And we all have things we wish we could go back and do again. Once time has shown there was a better way. But if your head rests easy on your pillow, my friend, that's more than some can say. But I'm telling you, it makes no sense to mention names or pinpoint dates and places, 'cause every time I close my eyes, every time I close my eyes, I'll see different faces. Different faces.
If I said anything worth and interesting here, I have no idea. You know, we just talk. I forgot we were actually on the air.